Welcome to the Family Farm Podcast, priority topics for family medicine and community pharmacy. Hi everyone, my name is Tina Lian and I'm a fourth year pharmacy student at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Billy Lin, I'm a family practice resident at UBC. Welcome to this episode of our Family Farm Podcast. Last time, we covered the CCS guideline on diagnosis and treatment of chronic heart failure. And today, Tina, the student pharmacist will be covering more details on the medication drug classes.
That's right. So just as a quick summary, the major drug classes I'll go over today are the ACE inhibitors, the ARBs, beta blockers, the mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, loop diuretics, thiazides, digoxin, and vasodilators, and that's including isosorbide dinitrate and hydralazine. So for each drug classes, I'll go over their mechanism of action, their recommended dosing, the side effects, the contraindications, drug interactions, and lastly, monitoring plan. However, since we've covered ACE inhibitors, ARBs, and beta blockers previously, I will just talk about the recommended dosing for heart failure in these three drug classes. If you want to know more about these three drug classes, please refer to the hypertension episodes. So without further ado, let's start talking about ACE inhibitors. So these include the captopril, enalapril, lisinopril, ranapril, and trendolapril. And as a review from our last episode, ACE inhibitors are recommended for all asymptomatic patients with an ejection fraction less than 35% and all symptomatic heart failure patients with an ejection fraction less than 40%. The recommended dosing for enalapril, and that's Vasotec, is an initial dose of 1.25 to 2.5 milligram twice a day to a target dose of 10 milligram twice a day. As for ramipril, and that's Altase, the initial dose is 1.25 to 2.5 milligram twice a day, and the target dose is 5 milligram twice a day. And the last one I'll mention is trendolapril, and this is Mavic. Initial dosing is 1 milligram once daily, and the target dosing is 4 milligrams daily. So for patients on ACE inhibitor, you want to monitor their serum creatinine and potassium within 7 to 14 days after initiation of therapy or if there's any dose changes. So it is worth noting that the serum creatinine can increase up to 30% and potassium can also increase up to 5.6 millimoles per liter, and these increases are considered reasonable. Now the next class is the ARBs, and that's including candesartan, brand name Atacand, losartan, brand name Cozar, Valsartan, brand name Diovan. And once again, as a review, it is used for patients that are intolerant to ACE inhibitors. It's also used as an add-on therapy to ACE inhibitor if the patient is intolerant or contraindicated to the use of beta blockers. And also, it is used as an add-on therapy to ACE inhibitors and beta blocker if the patient has an NOI-HA class 2 to 4 heart failure and an ejection fraction less or equals to 40%, who are also at increased risk of heart failure events. Now, the dosing for candesartan is an initial dose of 4 milligrams daily to a target dose of 32 milligrams daily. And for losartan, initial dose is 12.5 milligrams daily to a target dose of 150 milligrams daily. And lastly, for valsartan, it's 40 milligrams twice a day to a target dose of 160 milligrams twice a day. And for monitoring, it's very similar to ACE inhibitors. So it's recommended for patients that are on ARBs to monitor for their serum creatinine and potassium 7 to 14 days after initiation of therapy or if there's any dose changes. And now for beta blockers, and that's including bisoprolol, carvedilol, and metoprolol. And as Billy mentioned in the previous episodes, these three beta blockers are the ones that studies have proven them effective. So for these beta blockers, it is recommended for all heart failure patients with an ejection fraction less or equals to 40%. And it's usually initiated at a low dose and titrated to a target dose or to a maximal tolerated dose, as there are quite a few side effects for patients when first starting off this medication. So the recommended dosing for bisoprolol is an initial dose of 1.25 milligram daily to a target dose of 10 milligrams daily. As for carvedilol, It's an initial dose of 3.125 milligrams twice a day to a target dose of 25 milligrams twice a day. As for metoprolol, the most studied formulation is the XL formulation, which is the succinate salt. However, this is only available in the US. Here in Canada, we have the tartrate salt, which is metoprolol SR, which has not been shown to reduce mortality in patients with heart failure according to therapeutic choices. ARCS files did mention a recommended dosing for the SR formulation, and that is an initial dose of 12.5 to 25 milligrams once daily to a target dose of 200 milligrams once daily. And as for the most studied metoprolol succinate, which is the metoprolol XL, the target dose is recommended to be 200 milligrams once daily as well. So for patients on beta blockers, you want to monitor their blood pressure and heart rate before initiating this medication and before any increase in dose. Also, you want to watch for signs and symptoms of heart failure decompensation when initiating or increasing the dose. So it's important to pay close attention to their morning body weight as well. And as I have mentioned before, it is important to start beta blockers at a very low dose and slowly titrate the dose at a 2 to 4 week intervals. And now for the next few classes of medications, I'll go more into the details of them as we haven't mentioned them before. So now for the mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, and that's including eplerenone and spironolactone. So this class of medication is recommended for patients greater than 55 years of age with a mild to moderate heart failure during a standard heart failure treatment, with ejection fraction less or equal to 30%, and had a recent hospitalization for cardiovascular disease, or for patients with an elevated BNP or NT-proBNP levels, or for patients after an MI with an ejection fraction less or equal to 30% and heart failure, or for patients with diabetes and ejection fraction less or equal to 30% alone, or for patients with a severe chronic heart failure that's NYHA class 3B to 4, despite optimization of other drug treatment therapy, and with an ejection fraction less than 30%. Now, for mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, it's also known as aldosterone antagonist. Its mechanism of action involves competitive binding of receptors at the aldosterone-dependent sodium-potassium exchange site in the distal convoluted renal tubule. And because of this binding, this class of medication provides an effective therapy for the edema and ascites in heart failure. It causes increased amounts of sodium and water to be excreted while potassium loss is minimized. The dosing for eplerenone is an initial dose of 25 mg daily every 2 days to a target dose of 50 mg daily. And for spironolactone, its initial dose is 12.5 mg daily every 2 days to a target dose of 25 to 50 milligrams per day. Now, a higher dose of spironolactone can be used for a stronger diuretic effect, but it's rarely used unless patient has a severe right heart failure. So its contraindications are anuria, acute renal insufficiency, Addison's disease or other condition associated with hyperkalemia, significant renal impairment, and concomitant use of heparin. Common side effects are dehydration, nausea, dizziness, diarrhea, also hyperkalemia has seen in some of the patients as well. Spironolactone can also cause gynecomastia. However, this is reversible upon discontinuation of the treatment. As for drug interactions, ACE inhibitors, ARBs, and potassium supplements can increase the risk of hyperkalemia if used together with spironolactone or eplerenone. NSAIDs can also decrease the diuretic effect and worsens renal function if used together. For patients on this class of medication, it is important to monitor their serum creatinine and potassium 3 days and 1 week after initiating or titrating the dose, and you want to repeat every 1 to 3 months once stable. And to the next class of medication, the loop diuretics, and this include furosemide, brand name Lasix, and ethacrenic acid. Now, loop diuretics are for most patients with heart failure and congestive symptoms. However, when the acute congestion is cleared, the lowest dose should be used that is compatible with stable signs and symptoms. Its mechanism of action includes inhibiting the sodium-potassium chloride cotransporter in the thick ascending loop of Henle. This results in a decreased renal absorption of sodium, chloride, and water. The recommended dosing for furosemide is 20 to 500 milligrams per day given daily to twice a day for decompensated heart failure. And for ethacrenic acid, it's 50 to 200 milligrams daily or divided twice a day. Contraindications are gout and anuria. Its side effects include dehydration, hypokalemia, hypocalcemia, nausea, hypotension, azotemia, hypomagnesemia, anorexia, hyperglycemia, hyperuricemia, weakness, fatigue, rash, increase in total cholesterol, and ototoxicity with high doses. And for drug interactions, if used together with lithium, it can cause lithium toxicity. And with digoxin, it can induce digoxin toxicity if potassium is depleted. So it's important to monitor a patient's potassium level if they're on digoxin and loop diuretics together. Also, if used together with corticosteroids, it can cause hypokalemia. And if used with NSAIDs, it can decrease the diuretic effect and increase renal toxicity. And lastly, if used with thiazide diuretics, it may induce hypokalemia, hypomagnesemia, dehydration, and renal dysfunction. So it's important to monitor patients' morning daily weight, creatinine, BUN, GFR, potassium, magnesium if they're on loop diuretics. It's important to hold a diuretic if the patient's serum creatinine increased greater than 30% from baseline. Now for the next class of medication, thiazides, as we've discussed thiazides in the hypertension episodes as well, I'll just briefly go over the dosing range of two thiazide medication for heart failure, and those are chlorthalidone and hydrochlorothiazide. The recommended dosing for chlorthalidone is 50 to 100 milligrams daily. The maximum dose is 200 milligrams per day, and you want to use a lower dose when combining with a loop diuretic. As for hydrochlorothiazide, the recommended dosing is 25 to 100 milligrams daily, given in one or two divided doses. The maximum is 200 milligrams per day. And also you want to use a lower dose in combination with a loop diuretic. And now for digoxin. Digoxin is used for patients in sinus rhythm who continue to have moderate to severe symptoms despite an optimal heart failure therapy. It's also for patients with a chronic atrial fibrillation and poor control of ventricular rate. Its mechanism of action involves both direct action on the cardiac muscle and a specialized conduction system and an indirect action on cardiovascular system mediated by the autonomic nervous system. And the direct and indirect action are dose related. So the indirect action involves the vagomimetic action, which is responsible for the effect on the SA and AV nodes, and also baroreceptor sensitization, which results in increased carotid sinus nerve activity and enhanced sympathetic withdrawal for any given increment in mean arterial pressure. So the consequence of these direct and indirect effects are positive ionotropic action, so which is an increase in the force and velocity of myocardial systolic contraction, slowing of the heart rate, which is a negative chronotropic effect, and decreased conduction velocity through the AV node. Now, in a higher dose, digoxin increases sympathetic outflow from the CNS to both cardiac and peripheral sympathetic nerves. This increase in sympathetic activity may be an important factor in digoxin toxicity. The recommended dosing for digoxin is 0.0625 to 0.25 milligrams daily. Patients with ventricular fibrillation is contraindicated to use digoxin. Also, digoxin should be used with caution in patients with an acute MI, AV block, chronic constrictive pericarditis, and for patients with significantly low heart rate and thyroid function. Side effects include anorexia, nausea, vomiting, visual disturbances, fatigue, dizziness, confusion, delirium, and cardiac arrhythmia. As for drug interactions, when taken with amiodarone, clarithromycin, cyclosporin, erythromycin, itraconazole, propafenone, quinidine, ritonavir, tetracycline, and verapamil, it can increase digoxin serum levels. On the other hand, digoxin levels can be decreased if used with antacids, cholestyramine, cholestipol, neomycin, rifampin, St. John's wort, and sulfasalazine. Also, medications such as amiodarone, beta blockers, diltiazem, and verapamil can increase the risk of bradycardia if used with digoxin together. Now, when patients are on digoxin, you want to make sure when you adjust dose, it is based on patient patient's weight, renal function, and concomitant drugs that they are taking. Also, you want to measure the trough serum concentrations at least 8 hours after administration and adjust the dose to maintain the serum concentration between 0.6 to 1 nanomoles per liter. Now to the last class of medications, the vasodilators, and those are isosorbide dinitrate and hydralazine. So this class of medications should be considered in addition to standard therapy for African Americans with systolic dysfunction. Also, it's used for heart failure patients unable to tolerate other standard treatment and with a chronic renal failure. Now in the case of heart failure, nitrates have not been shown to reduce mortality in the absence of hydralazine, thus it is usually used together with hydralazine. As for nitrate monotherapy, it is valuable to treat symptoms of exercise-induced dyspnea or angina, paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, and orthopnea. As for mechanism of action, isosorbide dinitrate as well as other nitrates are prodrugs that donate nitric oxide by various mechanisms. Nitric oxide stimulates the guanylyl cyclase, leading to the conversion of guanosine triphosphate to cyclic guanosine monophosphate, which causes vasodilation. So these drugs relaxes the bronchial, biliary, gastrointestinal, ureteral, and uterine smooth muscle as well. As for the mechanism of hydralazine, it has a direct vasodilatory effect that leads to a reduction in peripheral vascular resistance. This effect is greater in the arterioles than in veins, resulting in a greater reduction in diastolic than systolic blood pressure and produces little orthostatic hypotension. The decrease in peripheral resistance is usually accompanied by a reflex tachycardia and an increase in cardiac output and stroke volume. Now, when combining the use of hydralazine and nitrate, it can reduce cardiac preload and afterload by achieving both venous and arterial vasodilation. Hydralazine is an arterial vasodilator and nitrates are predominantly venodilators. It has also been hypothesized that combining these two medications enhances nitric oxide bioavailability, since nitrates are nitric oxide donors and hydralazine is an antioxidant that reduces consumption of nitric oxide. The recommended dosing for hydralazine is an initial dose of 10 to 25 milligrams 3 times a day to a target dose of 75 milligrams 3 to 4 times a day. And for isosorbide dinitrate, its recommended initial dose is 10 to 20 milligrams 3 times a day to a target dose of 40 milligrams 3 to 4 times a day. As for contraindications, isosorbide dinitrate is contraindicated for patients taking phosphodiesterase inhibitors or those with severe anemia and shock. And for hydralazine, it is contraindicated for patients with dissecting aortic aneurysm and rheumatic heart disease. Now, the side effects for hydralazine includes hypotension, GI complaints, and lupus-like syndrome. And for isosorbide dinitrate, it includes headache and hypotension. So isosorbide dinitrate can interact with sildenafil, vardenafil, and tadalafil, causing severe hypotension. Thus, it is not recommended for patients taking these medications to take isosorbide dinitrate together. And this brings us to the end of this episode. And now Billy will give you a quick summary of all the drug treatments.
All right. Thank you, Tina. And it's good to be back. So basically, there are outcome-modifying therapy and symptomatic therapy. For outcome-modifying therapy, it is recommended that everyone with a heart failure with reduced ejection fraction to be started on an ACE inhibitor plus a beta blocker. And if they're intolerant to ACE inhibitors, then they should be on ARBs. And for these, they should be titrated to target doses or at least as much as they can tolerate. After being on these therapy, if they're still having symptoms and they fall into NYHA class 2 to 4, then they should be considered to add an aldosterone receptor antagonist. If they cannot tolerate eplerenone or spironolactone, then they should add ARB to an ACE inhibitor and the beta blocker as a triple combination. If they're still symptomatic and fall into NYHA class 2 to 4, then they can consider starting digoxin or hydralazine plus isosorbide dinitrate. However, if their symptoms become well controlled, then they should continue routine disease management and follow up. If, however, the patient has heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, then there is very little evidence-based outcome-modifying therapy. For these patients, the medical therapy should be aimed at optimizing their underlying medical condition, such as hypertension and cardiac ischemia. If the patient experiences symptoms of congestion, such as shortness of breath or peripheral edema, then they could try a diuretic to relieve the congestive symptoms. The first-line diuretic is a loop diuretic, and the most commonly used agent is furosemide. If, however, they still have symptoms of congestion after optimizing furosemide, they could be considered to add a second-line diuretic, such as a thiazide diuretic, but this must be done very carefully in a monitored setting. And as mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, we only covered the chronic congestive heart failure with this episode. For acute exacerbation of congestive heart failure, there are other guidelines that we may cover in the future.
Thank you, Billy. That was very well summarized.
Well, thank you, Tina, for a great episode on the medications again.
Well, we hope you learned a lot in this episode.
For our next episode, I think we'll round out the CCS guideline on atrial fibrillation.
So if there are other cardiovascular disease topics that you're interested in and we haven't covered them yet, please give us some comments either on our website or on our Facebook group page. That's right, we have a Facebook group page right now.
And we'll post a link to our Facebook page on our website, fppodcast.org.
So we're definitely looking forward to discussing atrial fibrillation with you guys.
Until then, thank you for listening.
And we'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Family Farm Podcast. Please leave your feedback and check out our show notes at fppodcast.org.